Are you looking for a new devotional resource in 2019? The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February is Day by Day in Genesis, 365 Devotional Readings by Martin Luther. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month, Day by Day in Genesis, 365 Devotional Readings by Martin Luther.
To defend the dignity of every person, I am asking Congress to pass legislation to prohibit the late-term abortion of children who can feel pain in the mother's womb.
Do you see how uncomfortable that would make people in the press to have to cover Feminist for Life? There's the gender issue, but now the weapon of gender and feminism is being used by people on the wrong side of the issue.
The picture of the shepherd leading the sheep, right? I mean, that's not at all the sheep saying, look what I'm doing, I'm following my man. It's like, you know, hey, it's the guy that gets us the protection. He's the guy that gives us all of our nourishment. He's the guy that we need to be with to be safe.
UC Berkeley alumni who still support the freedom of speech love Issues, Etc. Fiat Lux and Go Bears.
During my time as a parish pastor, I did some premarital counseling. At the time, I had not been married long enough to know what I was talking about. I had, I think, a sound theological understanding of marriage, but in terms of the practical, living out day to day for the rest of your life until death do we part, part of marriage, I simply hadn't lived enough of that to have gained any practical wisdom or experience. So the premarital counseling that I offered was of a far more general nature, and I think sometimes I simply boiled it down to one thing, and that is just learn to forgive each other. That's all you really know, really need to know for the rest of your life until death do you part. Was that sufficient? Greetings and welcome to Issues, Etc. Live on this Wednesday afternoon, February the 13th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be in part five of our series on marriage and divorce today, some practical advice. Pastor David Peterson will be our guest. A little bit later, Margot Cleveland joins as senior contributor to The Federalist. We're going to talk about parental rights and transgender affirmation. Then John Lomparis, United Methodist Director of the Institute on Religion and Democracy, will be our guest to talk about some academic leaders, in fact, almost 100 of them, calling for the acceptance of homosexuality in the United Methodist Church. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, @issuesetc. And the Issues, Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us for part five of our series on marriage and divorce today with some practical advice I could have used, Pastor David Peterson, pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and departmental editor of Gottesdienst, the Journal of Lutheran Liturgy. David, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be here.
I think in my pastoral ministry days, I sometimes copped out, but it was a lack of experience as well. But I copped out and essentially told those who were coming to me for premarital advice, just learn to forgive one another. That's all there is to it. How would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, of course, forgiveness is a big part of it because it's a big part of the Christian life. But if we're going to take marriage seriously theologically, then we have to really consider what it is, even down to its nuts and bolts. I mean, if we're going to take the Lord's Supper serious theologically, then we have to at some point talk about what is bread and wine. And even though the Lord's Supper is given for the forgiveness of sins, there is more to it than that, and we need to know more than that. So also in holy marriage, we need to know what it is to be a man, to be a woman. We need to know what it is to live together and what our duties are to one another. There's just more to that than just simply forgiving one another.
So we are working, or you have been working, from a resource that has its strengths and its weaknesses. Reintroduce us to this book we're going to talk a little bit about.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the second half, mainly, of this book by Eli Finkel, entitled The All or Nothing Marriage. And we looked at the first half of this book in episode 3 of this series, so I don't want to review the whole thing, but let me just say that it's a great book, and it's based mainly on hard science research psychology. So it's got real evidence behind it. But it has its problems because Finkel's, I don't even know if he's a Christian. He's certainly not a Lutheran. He would allow divorce without biblical cause. He doesn't uphold the Bible's view that marriage is between one man and one woman. And he certainly doesn't hold a bit to a biblical sexual morality within marriage. I would not recommend this book to engaged couples. I think that this book is a great book in many ways, and it's help to pastors who are going to conduct premarital instruction, but I wouldn't give it to the couple themselves. It could perhaps be given with caveats, with warnings to mature Christians who are struggling in their marriages, but of course it could be dangerous also, but at that point, sort of everything's dangerous. In any case, the first half of the book, if you remember, considers how the common view of marriage in America has changed over time, really as America has become more prosperous. And what Finkel does is he compares this to Maslow's pyramid of hierarchy of needs. He's a psychologist. So Maslow, you may remember, thought that there's a hierarchy of human needs that drives all human beings. So you have to have the bottom levels before you're going to care about the higher levels. And the bottom level is basic necessities, food and water. And then the second level is safety. So the argument is, if you have food and water, then you're not going to leave the cave and go face the saber-toothed tiger because you're going to stay safe. But if you don't have water, then that's more important, and so you will risk your safety. Safety gets compromised. And it goes on up into things that are less essential, as it were. And the highest level for Maslow is artistic expression, higher thought, and that sort of thing. If everything else in place, we can do that. So what Finkel does is attempt to demonstrate that in colonial America, marriage was really just about getting food and water. It was just about, and being safe. It was about the most basic necessities. And it was a business arrangement that had almost nothing to do with romance or really much in terms of affection. And then in the period after the Civil War, when life was more stable and safe, marriage did go to kind of a higher purpose, namely romance and the idea of romantic love and we should love one another. And now, he says, that even has been superseded, so that now Americans are looking to marriage to actually be really kind of the equivalent of artistic expression and philosophical inquiry. That is, that holy marriage is supposed to fulfill all of our needs, help us become the best person we could ever be, and live our best life possible. And he thinks that this is why marriages are failing at a greater rate in America than at any other time in the past. But he also notices that actually there are a slim minority of marriages that in fact achieve something close to that ideal, and they are the happiest marriages in a sense that the world has ever known. So that's the whole thesis. Why are marriages going so bad, and yet these few marriages are doing so well? The portion of the second half of the book that we're going to be interested in, there's more to the book, but that we're interested in is the eminently practical stuff that comes out of this research about the happiest marriages. What do those people do that's different? And a large part of it can really be summed up with two basic things: that we need to lower our expectations of marriage, and we need to work harder at keeping the eighth commandment, though there's some particulars about both of those things. Now, the danger, he says, of this kind of all-or-nothing approach to marriage is that very few people get all. And if it's all or nothing, if you don't get all, you get nothing. So an awful lot of people, because of this high ideal of marriage, quit on marriage because their marriages just aren't good enough. That is, that their marriages aren't fulfilling. They don't feel like they're with their soulmate. Finkel, in contrast, is very realistic about the hardships that all marriages are going to face over time, and that sometimes marriage just has to be endured while we wait for things to get better. And what he tells us, based again on research, is that it almost always will get better, and that we do really well to heed that perspective in the midst of hardship, exhaustion, and so forth. In fact, the example he comes back to the most is young couples who are newly married who have very young children. And of course, the children take almost all of the time and all of the energy and put lots of stress on marriage. But most people are able to recognize that that extreme circumstance isn't going to last, and hopefully things will get better. And in fact, they usually do. So that's the first thing. The second thing then is that not every marriage, maybe even not even most marriages, will ever reach this kind of highest purpose or ideal of marriage where, you know, we're having intellectual conversations that are stimulating and fascinating and great sex and all this stuff. But even if we don't reach that absolute ideal, marriages can still be rewarding, useful, and satisfying, good for us, good for society, and the like. Now, he gives very concrete ideas about marriage, about our expectations, how to manage them while not settling. And he also spends a lot of time listing all of the stressors that detract from marriage. And I don't think we need to spend any time on that. We know what that is. And he acknowledges that sometimes a less than ideal marriage, even some pain in marriage, has to be endured for long stretches of time, even for years, but that there's a reward for it. So if your spouse is going through a major clinical depression, if you can endure and wait for him to get better and help him get better, you really can come back to a much happier place, even if you don't get all the way to the top of Maslow's pyramid. So the goal is not simply to find a way to cope in a loveless marriage, not for Finkel and not for us. Our goal and his goal is to work toward a better marriage and to become a better spouse. It's important to frame how we think about marriage in the first place, because ideas have consequences, and what we think is what causes how we behave. So then finally, what we'll get to is that Finkel has 8 little tactics or techniques based upon research for how to be a better spouse and make a better marriage. And in many ways, that's the most interesting part of the book.
So I'm fascinated by this idea of not only lowering, but you say recalibrating, managing expectations. What do we find there?
Well, so we have this kind of irony where we don't want to just settle for, you know, well, marriage is going to be hard, it'd be terrible, and I'm going to be unhappy. There is this kind of balance of raising the standard and having a goal that's good, but at the same time being realistic. Let me read to you a paragraph from Finkel where he quotes somebody else here. Here's what he says about this, why to recalibrate. He writes, another psychologist who writes, "There are many marital therapists who have high expectations for what is possible in marriage. I am not opposed to such views, but I personally take a different one. I am a plumber, in quotation marks. I have often found my goal is fostering the good enough marriage. I am likely to think a marriage is good enough if the two spouses choose to have coffee and pastries together on a Saturday afternoon and really enjoy the conversation, even if they don't heal one another's childhood wounds or don't always have wall socket, mind-blowing, skyrocket sex." So that's this just really kind of genius reality of backing off and thinking about what's our goals of marriage, what is God given in marriage, what's the definition, how do we get there, instead of letting sort of, you know, romantic sitcoms or whatever define it for us. So that's kind of the first thing. And that's an important sort of thing, that we just sort of realize that what we think and how we speak about this matters. Next, it's really interesting to me that even though he's not with us in terms of what marriage really is, he does give evidence in this book that monogamy is both realistic and also possible, even though he doesn't think it's for everyone. And he admits also that monogamy, being faithful to one spouse for your whole life, is probably the most satisfying and fulfilling of all possibilities, even though he doesn't want to judge any of them. And he writes wise words that I think we should ponder about the sort of difficulty of being married to one man or one woman for your whole life. So I want to read that to you too. He writes, "Spouses who remain faithful to each other should recognize the scale of the sacrifice they are making for their love and for their children and should feel proud of their valor." So I think this is remarkable coming from a modern psychologist who accepts all the sorts of things that he does. Even he recognizes the honor, the valor in this. And I think we can be kind of bolstered and encouraged. We need to see that what we're doing is not going to be easy and it is going to have a cost. Next, he writes, "If we elect to adopt a monogamy norm in our own marriage, we should probably appreciate the magnitude of that commitment. We should consider either what others, things we're willing to forego in our marriage, or what additional investments we're willing to make for the arrangement to be fulfilling, perhaps including efforts to keep our bodies fit, and in some cases, to have sex even when we'd rather not." So we'll get to some of that later. But again, he recognizes that, and we should recognize that what we're engaged in is countercultural, is serious, and in some ways is going to be hard. So we need to recognize that our marriages are holy. So I'm out of Finkel now. This is a theological response, right? Our marriages are holy. God is the one who is making them. And I don't mean to speak in the way of destiny, but rather in the way of growth. This is something that's happening in real time right now. And that they involve at a base level always sacrifice, right? Forsaking all others is a sacrifice. Now, we should note that monogamy can be restored if it's been lost. That is to say, if there's been adultery or an affair. That's going to be painful and it's going to leave scars, but it can be done. And in fact, it's frequently done by Christians. Good enough marriage in terms of monogamy can be, we are renewed in our monogamy. We have been through confession and absolution. We're working on rebuilding trust and intimacy. We know we aren't perfect, and we trust in God's grace anyway. And we know that this, staying together, being monogamous from now on, is best for our kids, best for society, and our own best path toward happiness. So what's not good enough in terms of managing our expectations would be an unrepentant partner who won't break off an affair. So that's the first recalibration, to sort of think about the sacrifice that marriage requires and to think about what God is really doing and has promised for holy marriage, which is not happiness, but there is the hope of joy and satisfaction and the hope of happiness in marriage.
Pastor David Peterson is our guest. It's our series on marriage and divorce today, some practical advice. We'll talk about good enough sex when we come back. He's pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and departmental editor of Gottesdienst, the Journal of Lutheran Liturgy. Several Issues, Etc. regular guests are candidates for leadership positions in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Every LCMS congregation has received nomination forms for the president and vice presidents of the synod. Please encourage your pastor and congregational leaders to fill out and return these nomination forms before February 20th of 2019. Learn more at issuesetc.org/nominations. issuesetc.org/nominations.
The Lord is our shepherd, and we are the people of his pasture. Why then do we still suffer in this life? Disease, loneliness, persecution. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm collaborating with Cheryl Swope, Molly Hemingway, and a host of literary friends in He Restores My Soul, a book that takes an honest look at hardship and heartache in light of God's promises found in his word. He Restores My Soul is now available at emmanuelpress.us, emmanuelpress.us.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Join the tradition of Lutheran teacher education at Concordia University Chicago. Choose from early childhood, elementary, secondary, or special education tracks and learn to bring God's love into your classroom. Our programs are nationally accredited, so you'll be equipped to serve at one of 2,500 Lutheran schools across the United States. Visit cuchicago.edu to learn more and apply today.
In the family of God, we never run out of people to love. This line from Robert Zagore's article, Who is My Neighbor?, cuts to the heart of the Lutheran Witness's February issue on mercy. Beginning with the earliest Christians and carrying the story forward to present-day mercy work in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, this issue will open eyes to Christ's great love for the church and the church's great love for a world in need. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Well, Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's our series on marriage and divorce with Pastor David Peterson. We're discussing marriage and divorce, the place to go first in Holy Scripture for an understanding of marriage. Its origin in God's creation of Adam and Eve is, of course, the book of Genesis, a foundational book in all of the Bible in more than one sense, including on the subject of marriage. Jesus goes back to Genesis for marriage. The apostles go back to Genesis for marriage. That's why we're offering, as our Issues, Etc., book of the month for February, Day by Day in Genesis. It's a devotional resource from the pen of 16th century Martin Luther. Find out more about Day by Day in Genesis. Call Concordia Publishing House and order this devotional, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Pastor Peterson, they're talking again about kind of managing these expectations in marriage or recalibrating them. What about good enough when it comes to the sexual relationship?
Well, in the first place, sex is not optional. Intercourse is not optional, at least for people that are healthy and the like. St. Paul says that a husband and wife cannot deny one another or deprive one another, and they should give each other their conjugal rights. Now, Finkel documents, again from research, that married couples are actually having less sex today than in past generations. Though, if it matters to anybody, they're having way more sex than single people. So I guess that's good. He blames this on cell phones and the internet, and I think he's probably right. That is, that we're just simply busier and we're more distracted than ever before, and we just don't make time for this because we've got so many sort of entertainment options and we're tired from work at the end of the day. He also documents that the research shows, I mean, this is no surprise, that when one spouse or the other isn't in the mood, but goes along with it just, you know, out of love for the spouse, the one who wasn't in the mood always seems to end up enjoying it. And it's just usually that, you know, he or she just doesn't want to feel like making an effort or doesn't want to get off the couch and so forth. So research shows, in any case, that sexual intercourse in a marriage strengthens feelings of affection, and thereby the marriage gets stronger and the likelihood of divorce goes down. He also demonstrates that once a week sex is kind of the minimum to see an increase in the benefit being you're less likely to get divorced in the next 10 years. So there's no significant gain to more frequent sex, but there's a definite weakening with less. And his advice is simply that we all in holy marriage ought to just make this a goal to have sex once a week, and that we shouldn't pretend like this is just pure romance and we have to wait for spontaneity and all this sort of thing. And I know that sounds a little bit awkward and mechanical, but it's good advice, and it's reasonable, and it also staves off other problems. As St. Paul warns us, it's better to marry than burn, so it helps deal with, it just keeps marriages safer as well as building affection and the like. And the same, by the way, can be said for other physical intimacy, that it's good for marriage. And we'll get into that a little bit later, but research also shows that just simple things like holding hands while watching a movie or not leaving in the morning without a kiss and similar physical contact build feelings of affection and are good for both partners, even if one is kind of faking it and just doing it because he's supposed to. Still good. So that's worth knowing. Now, we've already talked on here about what's out of line in the marriage bed, and I don't want to repeat it. And also the God-given purposes of intercourse in earlier episodes, but those things need to be kept in mind as also. Now, that all being said, you know, the good enough sex is, it ought to be that we actually are deliberate about it, but it is possible, and we need to say this often, I think, and loudly, it is possible to live a celibate life within marriage. Human beings do not have a biological necessity to have intercourse. It's not ideal in marriage, but it's totally possible. And some Christians, of course, have to suffer this due to physical disabilities on the part of their spouse or themselves. And others, of course, others have to suffer it simply because of who they married and because the marriage is in a bad place and things aren't happy. Now, we don't want to settle for this, but we can recognize that it may be what we have to accept for a time and hope that it will improve through various efforts. So it is not a biblically valid reason to get a divorce because your wife's not having enough sex with you. And I mean, this is a common kind of complaint that, that should not be accepted in the church. We need to learn how to love one another. You need to work through this and the like, but you can't quit because of that. Now, what is not good enough, you know, what we can't tolerate is, of course, abuse, degradation, or adultery. Now, those things may not require divorce, but they might require divorce depending on the level of them and if they won't stop. So they certainly require addressing and change. They can't go on.
What about conversation? I mean, there was a time when the fad was the key to a good marriage is good communication, but we do need to say something about conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And because ideally, husband and wife would have daily, delightful conversations about the most important of topics, and they would challenge and support each other in all sorts of personal growth. And in the first episode, we actually talked about the fact that marriage really is mainly conversation, because we mainly live in our minds, and that's the main companionship that we need from one another. So what's good enough here? What can we kind of settle for as realistic, or what might we have to endure for a time? I mean, it might be simply inquiring about one another's days and showing some sympathy and awareness of what the other's interested in. But there really does need to be conversation, because we do live in our minds. So also, though, we are unrealistic if we place this entire burden, everything that we need kind of intellectually and emotionally, on our spouses, because we are meant to live in communities. So it's both unrealistic and it turns out unhealthy, according to the research, to expect our spouse to meet all of this. And Fickle cites research that shows that couples who have friends, each of them have friends who support one of seven different emotional needs, end up having way stronger marriages. So it turns out that we do best if we have specific friends that do specific things for us in this regard. And the seven things are: cheer us up when we're sad, calming us down when we're angry, calming us down when we're anxious, capitalizing on happiness, amplifying our anger — that would be, you know, anger when we're justifiably angered — reducing guilt and reducing embarrassment. And in the research, it turns out that the ideal number, the greatest return, comes if you have four friends and each of those four friends does just one of those things. So only four of those things get done by outsiders or people outside your spouse. And it turns out that friends who overlap, who do more than one thing, that doesn't help. You still need four different people. So the research shows your ideal thing is you have a spouse who's your main confidant, and then you have four close, intimate friends, not best friends necessarily, but that are a support network. So most ideal would for all of us would be if we had these four close friends who could do these things for us, and if all four of them were either members of our congregations or members of our family who share our faith. I mean, this is part of what Paul's getting at when he writes in Romans 12 that we should weep with those who weep and we should rejoice with those who rejoice. We need that, and we were created to live together and to share these kinds of burdens and joys. But good enough might be that we have to get almost all of our support from our spouse, or very, very little, and we have to sort of deal with it and make the best of it that we can. Now, I want to issue a word of caution here. Certainly, it's important to not place all of that burden on our spouses, but people always resist me when I bring this up and argue with me, but I'm convinced of it completely. And that is that we should not, none of us, should get this sort or this level of support or have this sort of friend with members of the opposite sex. I'm saying that men should not have women friends that they get this kind of support from, that should be reserved for the intimacy of holy marriage or for same-sex friends. Now, I suppose you could make an exception for a sibling, but that's probably the only exception. I can be friends with women at a very casual level, or I can be friends with women that my wife is friends with if we're friends with them as a couple. But I should not have women friends, and my wife should not have men friends, not this sort of friends. It's simply inappropriate. I mean, if some man friend of my wife called my house to just talk to my wife for an hour, that's wrong. highly dangerous. I don't have a Bible passage to prove that, but it's wrong. And I think that this comes down to this forsaking all others means that you give up friends for your spouse, even if, you know, this person was your friend from grade school and it's completely platonic and the like. That so we need friends, but there's always kinds of dangers involved. The other thing about friends is, you know, your friends that are going to provide this kind of support and encourage and help your marriage probably need to be married themselves, certainly not divorced. Because the difficulty there is, and I mean, I'm sure there's probably exceptions and so forth, but the problem is you need somebody who loves holy marriage and supports it for this, who's going to be, yeah, your wife is a jerk and that sort of stuff.
I want to just dig a little deeper on that before we take our break. Why do you think it is you get such pushback? I've witnessed that. I have learned that in the course of being married now more than 30 years, that it is a bad idea. You said wrong. I say bad, bad idea for men and women, husbands and wives, have marriage or to have friends like that of the opposite sex. Besides siblings, I think siblings are the exception.
We get pushback because, first of all, we think more highly of our abilities to resist temptation than is realistic, and secondly, we just never want to give anything up. And in my fallen flesh, I sometimes think we get pushback too because there's something sinful and broken in us that's actually trying to keep other options open. Now, maybe that last part's going too far, but it's a bad, bad idea. And I know people keep arguing with me about this, but I'm going to keep telling them because I think I got to warn them.
Do you think it's also born of the mistaken notion largely given to us by feminism that men and women are interchangeable?
Yes, absolutely. We ought to be able to just look at people as people without noticing their genitalia. But the truth is there are no people without genitalia, and genitalia are defining. God made us men and women, and it matters.
Pastor David Peterson is our guest. It's part 5 of our series on marriage and divorce. Today, some practical advice. He's pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and departmental editor of Gottesdienst, the Journal of Lutheran Liturgy. We're going to talk about hopes and some other practical advice, how to counter weaknesses both in ourselves and our spouse after this. Are you looking for a new devotional resource in 2019? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February is Day by Day in Genesis, 365 Devotional Readings by Martin Luther. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Day by Day in Genesis, 365 Devotional Readings by Martin Luther.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union was formed to serve you and to serve the church. During February, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to their Ministry of the Month, Perry Lutheran Homes. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU, good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry, lcms.org/deaconess.
Be strong and courageous from Joshua 1:9 is the theme for the 41st academic year at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois. We engage young adults in a Christ-centered environment and provide an alternative to secular public high schools. Please help us provide tuition assistance to more students by making a tax-deductible gift at melhs.org and click on the giving page. Or call me, Dr. Jay Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Theology for blue collar, white collar, and clerical collar. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Our Savior Lutheran, Houston, Texas. Faith Lutheran, Capistrano Beach, California. Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Wayne, Indiana. First Bethlehem Lutheran, Chicago, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Clarinda, Iowa. Peace Lutheran, Filer, Idaho. Augsburg Lutheran, Shawnee, Kansas. Glory of Christ Lutheran, Plymouth, Minnesota. St. John Lutheran, Napoleon, Ohio. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Dallas, Texas. St. Peter's Lutheran, Arlington, Wisconsin. And Peace with Christ Lutheran, Fort Collins, Colorado. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. It's our series on marriage and divorce with Pastor David Peterson. We're getting some practical advice today. A little bit later, we're going to spend some time with Margot Cleveland, senior contributor to The Federalist, an attorney and a graduate of Notre Dame Law School. She's going to bring us up to date on parental rights and transgender affirmation, and we'll talk about some academic leaders, in fact, almost 100 of them, calling for the acceptance of homosexuality in the United Methodist Church with John Lamparis. Pastor Peterson, what's the difference between high expectations or overly high expectations and high hopes?
Well, the danger with high expectations is that if they aren't met, they can create resentment. But at the same time, we really should have high hopes based on our theology of marriage and based upon this research, in a sense. And prioritizing marriage, being deliberate about it, can elevate it and, in a sense, is needed. High hopes are needed to elevate it. So there could be people listening who are living in less than fully satisfying marriages. And part of the answer for those people as Christians is to say, and it sounds terrible, but kind of lower your expectations and don't look at marriage simply as, is this making me happy or not? But ask yourself some more fundamental questions like, is my husband working? Are we paying the bills? Is there enough food? Am I safe? And if those things are being met, you know, give thanks to God for that, you know, and then ask, you know, is he cheating on me? You know, and so to look for sort of what has God given, and then to say, okay, I can endure at this level while we look at and work on making it better. And it can get better. There's not a promise that it will, but there are things that we can do. And that's kind of our next section.
Okay. So you call, or it's being called love hacks. What are they?
Well, this is Finkel's terminology. He made this up, and I want to read you a couple of definitions that he gives. And by the way, I always get kickback on this also. People are really resistant to the idea that we would try to take an active role in our marriages to make them happier, which is kind of nonsense to me. But I think it's like, it's a bit like when Judas is upset that the oil's too expensive and there's poor people. Why are we wasting oil? So look, God created marriage for the goodness of the world, and he wants us to enjoy it. It was created before the fall. It's part of the goodness. So to desire some happiness in marriage is not simply selfish and terrible. And to take some deliberate efforts at it is not manipulative. It's good stewardship of what you've been given. So he calls this love hacks, sort of like life hacks. This is what he writes. Love hacking involves a deliberate effort to see the beautiful underneath the anger and disappointment and boredom, to look with appreciative new eyes. That's why I say in lots of ways this is kind of just Eighth Commandment stuff. But that's all he's really trying to do, is he's trying to help us through kind of very specific actions that we can take to see the beautiful underneath, to see what God has actually given or created. And then he writes again in a few pages, love hacks, this is what he's proposing here, these eight things, have three defining features. First of all, they don't take much time. Second, they don't require any coordination with or cooperation from our spouse. Third, they don't require that we modulate our expectations. So what's great about these is these are things that you can do even if your spouse is uncooperative or doesn't seem to care about this at the moment. So he then writes that really what he's doing here is he's giving us very specific examples, which, by the way, he doesn't have a lot of research to back up these exact examples. But what he's got is he's got research that shows the principles behind this have been demonstrated by research to be true. And the examples are these love hacks are meant to create a more general way of thinking about how to implement quick and dirty procedures to benefit our marriage, how to sort of change the way we think and to act in a more appropriate way.
So they're in two general categories, I take it, that is dealing with both weaknesses and strengths?
Yeah, that's right. So first of all, he's got sort of ways to counter weaknesses. So he's got four for that, and then he's got four things that savor strength. So the first one is just, he says, to deliberately, intentionally make external temporary attributions for negative behavior. Now that sounds kind of fancy and convoluted, but what he's thinking about is we don't judge motives of our spouse when our spouse does something we don't like, but we assume instead that our spouse is a good person. And he gives this beautiful example in a chart here when your spouse was late. So the worst thing you could do is attribute that to being internal and stable. So you would say to yourself, my spouse is late because he's a thoughtless jerk. That's who he is as a person, the way he always is, right? Not quite as bad would be, my spouse was late because he forgot to set his alarm. So that's at least only temporary, but it still is a flaw in him. So that would be a problem. Or you could have another not quite as bad, but bad. My spouse was late because his crappy car broke down again. So it's external to him, but it's an ongoing condition, and that's a problem. And then he says, so here's what we want. This is great sort of thought experiment about how to keep the eighth commandment. The best is where you would assign it to be both temporary and external. Your spouse, and you would say, my spouse was late because he got stuck in traffic. So it's a temporary condition, and it's also external to him. So, you know, that's just good advice and biblical advice about how to not judge motives and put the best construction on things. But he's asking here us to do as husbands and wives is to be very deliberate about it, to think about it, to strategize. And when we catch ourselves, you know, thinking these bad things about our wives or our husbands, to stop and rethink it and be specific in that. His next one is to cultivate gratitude. And there's been lots of research about the benefits psychologically for health and for happiness in cultivating gratitude. But of course, he's talking about specifically here in holy marriage that we would, and he suggests doing things like pausing while you're in the shower or, you know, before you go to sleep at night every day and just listing the blessings that you have, thanks to give within marriage. And I mean, these are very simple things. My husband has a job. He goes to work every day. Or my husband comes to church with me. He believes in the same things I believe in. Or, you know, my husband doesn't beat me. I mean, just really, what are the things I really have to be thankful for and within marriage? And there almost inevitably are some things. You know, he loves our children. He's a good dad. And then besides just listing these, also, of course, expressing it, telling your wife or your husband what you're thankful for. It needs to be genuine. Don't make up stuff. But again, research shows that this creates and strengthens emotional bonds and is good. And I think, again, we'd say this kind of falls under the eighth commandment, and it's good. We could also think of 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, give thanks in all circumstances. Number three is that we need to deliberately celebrate together. And this means that you need to listen for good things that your spouse is saying that happened to him or to her that day. And I mean, it doesn't have to be giant things. It doesn't have to be get a promotion. It could be, you know, I found my keys. I got a good parking spot, you know, but to deliberately listen and then to be enthusiastic and sincere in sharing that little bit of joy. So it's kind of, you have to train yourself, depending on the sort of person you are, to sort of, you have to force yourself to respond to this and to give an expression to it in the goodness of the event or the moment. Again, I would say this is Romans 12, rejoice with those who rejoice. But research has shown that this is actually more important than being angry with the things that they're angry about in terms of predictors of who's going to get divorced, to rejoice in the little joys of life, to celebrate together. And then number four is affectionate touching. And it turns out that affectionate touching is good for marriage, even if it is forced and it isn't spontaneous. I mean, if you force yourself to, I'm going to hold her hand even though I don't feel like it, will create a stronger bond. And this one does have a lot of research behind it. I don't have a Bible passage for it, but it seems pretty harmless and pretty safe. And I think you should just do it.
Pastor David Peterson is our guest. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about countering weaknesses. It's part five of our series on marriage and divorce. We're getting some practical advice. He's departmental editor of Gottesdienst, the Journal of Lutheran Liturgy. Stay tuned. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference is coming to Chicago for its one and only 2019 conference. You can meet and hear Ross Douthat, Matt Harrison, Wesley Smith, Aaron Wolf, Hans Feeney, and Will Whedon Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
Sanctifying your vocations with the Word of God. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Holy Cross Lutheran Church, Moline, Illinois, invites you to join us in receiving the Lord's gifts in word and sacrament. Sunday services are at 8:15 and 10:45 a.m., with Bible class and Sunday school at 9:30 a.m. We are located in the Quad Cities at 4107 21st Avenue, Moline, Illinois. Welcome in the name of our Lord.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's part five of our series on marriage and divorce. Today, some practical advice. Pastor David Peterson is our guest, departmental editor of Gottesdienst, the Journal of Lutheran Liturgy. You can find out more about this Lutheran confessional liturgical think tank at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. I want to circle back around a little bit, Pastor Peterson, and talk about some more ways to counter weakness. There's one of these love hacks that you discuss called to reappraise conflict. What does that mean?
What he's talking about there is that, again, we just set our minds to being deliberate about how we think about an argument or a conflict that happens in marriage, and that we become neutral and objective. And what he says is you need to just force yourself to describe it from a third-person perspective. So, you know, whatever it might be, there's some conflict over whether or not you took out the garbage or not. There's a temptation to, again, you know, assign blame to the other person and like, and instead they did an experiment where they made people describe this as though they were courtroom reporters, and it ended up helping people to distance themselves from it, so it wasn't so emotional, but also it forced people to consider the other, their spouse's perspective. Again, this is just, it really is the Eighth Commandment in this case, but it's very useful, and it can help us from kind of going down the rabbit trail of getting ourselves angrier and the like.
There's going to be, as the longer two people live together, evident insecurity between two people, even two people who love each other deeply. What's the advice there?
That really, it's really important for us to believe the compliments and when our spouses say that they love us. So when you feel that a compliment's exaggerated or insincere, he's just telling me he loves me as meaningless words or whatever, again, what he says to do is to stop and explain it from the other person's point of view as to why he or she might see it this way and what that means to your marriage. And again, they did this, a couple of experiments where they kind of forced people to do this. And what happened was it strengthened the marriage and it helped people feel less insecure. So particularly people that are struggling with, you know, issues of low self-esteem and so forth, it's sometimes hard for them to hear compliments. And again, this is Eighth Commandment, but kind of applied to ourselves, it feels like, but it isn't. It really is believing in the sincerity of your spouse. So look, she said she loves me. I could judge her motives. I could make up an excuse. I could say she doesn't mean it, but I should just take her at face value and I should believe what she says. And it turns out that, again, you know, keeping the law the apology to the Augsburg Confession says that good works merit both spiritual and bodily benefits in this life and in the next. So keeping the law has benefits, and keeping the Eighth Commandment has benefits, huge benefits for marriage. So to believe compliments sometimes requires a kind of act of will and an intellectual exercise to step outside and say, yes, I'm going to believe that he does love me, and he would love me, he promised he would, and this means that our marriage can endure and last.
With about a minute here before we take our next break, you want to point out that we are not Calvinists when it comes to marriage. What do you mean?
Well, and this is many ways behind this whole book, that we don't take this destiny mindset that, you know, God made a soulmate for me before time began and I have to find that person and then everything will be good. That's not true. And people who believe that, their marriages fail at an astronomic rate. What we need to accept is a biblical model that God makes a marriage over time, that he doesn't predestine marriage. So what we need to do is we need to recognize and think in this way, that a successful marriage evolves and grows through hard work and by overcoming obstacles with the grace of God. Forgiveness is real and forgiveness changes us. We're capable of learning and growing. And this is really faith in God's promises and is an exercise in sanctification.
Pastor David Peterson is our guest. We'll have some more conversation with him in our series, Marriage and Divorce, getting some practical advice. On the other side of the break, we'll talk about that Eighth Commandment in marriage, how important it is. I think a lot of times, even Christians assume that the Eighth Commandment doesn't apply. Shouldn't you be able to say whatever you want to say or think whatever you want to think about this person to whom you're married? We'll correct that. A little later in hour two, Margot Cleveland will join us. We'll talk about parental rights being threatened by the transgender affirmation movement. And John Lamparis, United Methodist Director of the Institute on Religion and Democracy, will bring us up to date on some academic leaders calling for the acceptance of homosexuality in the United Methodist Church.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Repentance and forgiveness, sin and grace, law and gospel, more than cliches, real preaching for real people in need of hearing the real Christ. Christ for You and the Divine Service at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, where we gather every Saturday night at 6 and on the Lord's Day, Sunday mornings at 7:45 and 10. Look for the Church of the Neon Cross on I-55 between exits 30 and 33. Find us on the web, stpaullutheranchurchhamel.org. St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, where there is the forgiveness of sins, life and salvation for the people of God.
Give your spouse the gift of time for Valentine's Day with a gift certificate from The Cleaning Authority. Call toll-free 1-866-827-0062 or visit thecleaningauthority.com. Forget the flowers, candy, and jewelry this year with a Valentine's Day gift certificate from our favorite cleaning service, The Cleaning Authority, 866-827-0062 or thecleaningauthority.com.
Oh, morning star, oh, morning star, shine with the bright glow.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Pastor David Peterson is our guest. Our fifth part in our series on marriage and divorce continues for the next few minutes of the program. Some practical advice. I want to talk a little bit more about the eighth commandment in marriage. I've become convinced of this, that there is no place where the eighth commandment is more in play on a moment-by-moment basis than between husband and wife. And probably 90% of the sins I commit against my wife involve the eighth commandment in thought, word, or deed. And I think there was an insight. I might have got it from you. I'm pretty sure I got it from you. All my best ideas come from David Peterson. Was that if I am, as a husband, am called by God to protect, among other things, to protect my wife, that includes protecting her reputation, even from me. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the old joke is, does this dress make me look fat, right? And there is something broken inside of us that feels very self-righteous and thinks it's going to tell the truth, right? Well, I'm just going to give the facts. Yes, you look fat. But that's so wrong and at every level. In the first place, Luther doesn't believe that simply telling the truth keeps the eighth commandment. And Luther is a proponent for lying, for telling falsehoods in certain circumstances. And of course, the examples he gives are Rahab and the Egyptian midwives or the Hebrew midwives, whoever it was that protected Moses, that there's times when we should lie because we know the intent of the person asking the question and we're going to protect life and so forth. But you could also think about this in terms of the wife, the wife says, does this dress make me look fat? And if you really had time, to analyze and to think about this, what's the real question? And what she's asking is, and she's not even asking, am I beautiful? She's asking, am I beautiful to you, right? And that's what she needs to hear and the way that we need to respond. And that is a matter of the eighth commandment, of protecting her feelings and her worth and the like. The other thing that kind of goes with this, protecting her reputation, that I always tell the story about lying to the ladies' aid, because my wife doesn't want to go to the ladies' aid meeting. And when I show up at the ladies' aid meeting, I say, oh, she's not feeling well. I think that's totally the right thing to do because I don't want her to be embarrassed or those women to dislike her or whatever. But the other thing that sort of goes with this is that when we say what we're supposed to say, even though part of us doesn't believe it, we're making a confession against ourselves. So this is sort of like sometimes when marriages are struggling or in this hardship, one or the other spouse doesn't want to say, I love you, because he or she doesn't feel it. I'm not feeling this affection I call love. And what I always tell people is, first of all, love's more than just merely a flitting feeling of infatuation. But even so, just say it, because that's what you know is right and what you're supposed to do. And you made a promise when you got married that you would love her. So just do it. Just love her and say what's right and make this confession against yourself rather than dragging your existential angst into the whole world and causing great pain and sorrow by it.
There's something here that I think it took me a long time to figure out, and it did not come clear for me until my children were adults. And then I'm dealing with my children as adults, and I'm dealing with my wife after 30-plus years of marriage. And I finally had to come to terms with the fact that I love my children with all my heart. I absolutely do. But my wife is my highest priority. My wife, my first loyalty in a human sense must be to her. If my kids want to test that, then they will find out that my first loyalty is to her.
Yeah, right. For forsaking all others. You know, we just, that those words just fly off our lips so flippantly, but to forsake all others means, yeah, that includes children, that includes your mother, that includes your best friend, there's no one. She's it.
So another phenomenon that comes with the length of marriage is we soon discover that those flaws that we may have detected only in part when we first got married are magnified the older we get. I'm not less of what I was in terms of my weaknesses 30 years ago. I'm probably more in a lot of ways, especially those things that annoy my wife. Talk about dealing with that. That in some cases, I agree with your hoping for growth in the marriage, but in some cases, she's not going to get better and I'm not going to get better. In fact, as we get older and the filter begins to wear away, we might get a little worse.
Well, I think that's right. But so I don't mean by, you know, having high hopes for marriage that, you know, he's going to start picking his underwear up off the floor if he hasn't for 30 years, right? The you know, the best indicator of future behavior is past behavior. But what can happen is, and is possible to happen, is that you can grow together to come to a kind of recognition that leaving your underwear on the floor is not really that significant of an event. And you can learn to put a best construction on, you know, he doesn't throw his underwear on the floor because he's morally flawed as a human being and he's lazy and he doesn't care about me who has to pick them up. But you can learn to frame it in such a way as, you know, this is almost endearing that he's just so unaware of his surroundings because he's so focused on me that he just throws his underwear on the floor. I mean, maybe that's a bit of a, but I do think that it's possible to have high hopes that learns to live with grace with one another and learns to actually more than tolerate, you know, imperfections in behavior. I don't mean, of course, when we talk about this, I don't mean, when I say an imperfection behavior, I'm not talking about somebody who's beating his wife, who's cheating on his wife. There are, we'll talk about that at the next segment. There are times when actually divorce is necessary. So we're not talking about that, but I'm talking about the little annoyances, the imperfections, you know, the fact that, you know, he can't carry a tune or he takes too long of showers or, you know, you just can't get him to whatever it is. There can come almost a point to where it's almost endearing and you really can be tolerant of one another because of this grace that you extend to one another. And I think that's the high hopes for marriage. Not that we're going to start behaving better necessarily, but that we are going to learn to live in love and in forgiveness.
We've dealt with some sensitive issues in the course of this conversation. You've said some things that you have freely admitted are not well received. You said them elsewhere, and I'm sure we'll hear from our listeners too. There's one more, and I think it's an observation that men will generally come to in the course of a marriage. And that is, there are things that your wife can say to you that you can never say to your wife. It's simply true. You cannot say what she says to you. If you do, your marriage will be over. But she can say them to you. I don't know how it works out in terms of ego or any of that kind of stuff. I'm not a psychiatrist. It's just a truth. Address that pastorally.
Well, I think this is the difference between men and women and what were our roles within marriage, that our job as husbands is to protect and comfort and provide. And that's a different situation than the wife, whose job it is to nurture and to some degree to discipline. And even though we usually think of the father as the disciplinarian, but the bulk of it falls to the mother. And so I think that those are just simply the roles, that we are always concerned about protecting and providing, ideally, and that's why we would never say anything that could hurt or sting. And, you know, she's more interested in nurturing, and sometimes nurturing requires some rebuke or some correction, you know, a stating of whatever it is. So, right, I mean, I think my wife can say to me, you know, you're getting a little bit of a pot belly there, which would be an understatement. But I would never want to say it the other way. And I think that's because she has a different role in marriage to me than I do in marriage to her.
Finally, then, much of what we've talked about here is really just kind of practical, and we could even say pastoral advice. A lot of it has centered around the Eighth Commandment. How important is it, Pastor Peterson, that of all people, Christian pastors model this? This is even in our vows, for heaven's sakes, model this in their marriage, especially in an age when we now consider it a matter of routine that pastors' marriages fail.
Yeah, that's right. That is really a terrible shame. Well, as I was preparing for this and reading this book and thinking about these things, what I thought was so interesting was how almost all of this is applicable to all relationships. I mean, this I could take most of this and apply this to how I think and speak about the associate pastor and the organist and the principal. And it's, you know, because Eighth Commandment stuff, of course, is what we owe to all of each other. But that's exactly right. What I was thinking of was how pastors speak about their congregations. I mean, there is a, you know, the pastor does stand in the stead of Christ, the bridegroom. He's not the bridegroom, to be sure, but there is a Christological reality there that he is called upon to suffer for the congregation, to provide for her, to love her in some ways as Christ loved the church. And what a terrible broach of the office when we speak poorly of those that we've been called upon to love, our wives or our congregations. Yeah, and I don't know, you know, why do so many pastors' marriages fail? I don't think that they do fail at the same statistical rate as the general population. But I wonder if when they do fail, if it's because we've actually had these false expectations that we're going to have this perfect marriage because we're pastors, and kind of been unwilling to manage our expectations and suffer through the tough years.
Before we let you go, can you tell us a little bit about Emmanuel Press's latest book, He Restores My Soul?
It's a book edited by and written largely by Katie Sherman and I think 13 other authors or 11 other authors. And it's a book that deals very personally and closely with suffering, Christian women, and the unique sufferings that women have and crosses that they bear, infertility, being single, being barren, these sorts of things that in some ways our society can't even recognize as crosses. It's beautifully written and it's theologically sound, which of course we would expect. But I think one of the most valuable things it does is simply acknowledges these realities as painful and just names them. And then of course also does apply the gospel to them. So it's a very useful book. I think it, not just for women, obviously women are targeted, but I think everyone would benefit from this book.
You can learn more about the book, He Restores My Soul, under the Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org. Pastor David Peterson is pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and departmental editor of Gottesdienst, the Journal of Lutheran Liturgy. David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd.
On the other side of the break, Margot Cleveland will join us. We're going to talk about the conflict between parental rights and transgender affirmation. Comes in three waves, and it is not good news for parental rights. Stay tuned.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com and like them on Facebook. facebook.com/lutheracademy.
Jesus is the Word of God. He's also incarnate, born of the Virgin Mary and made man. The Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word is all about Jesus for you. A confessional liturgical parish in the Michigan District, we invite you to worship with us in our new location at the corner of Wattles and Livernois Roads in the Troy Museum and Historic Village, Troy, Michigan. LCIW.org.
Lutheranism in the public square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I think every man, every Christian should consider, at least, the possibility of God calling him into the holy ministry.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Carl Fekencher of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Because that's the way that God has designed for faith in Christ Jesus to be spread, for the gift of eternal life that Christ Jesus earned by his death and resurrection to be shared with people, by the washing of baptism for infants and for adults, for the instruction, the proclamation of the word that happens on a nonstop basis in God's kingdom. God uses people, he uses men to be those proclaimers, to be those men who share the sacraments.
If you've ever considered becoming a pastor, contact Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Their phone number, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu.